Great. Seems like everything is working. So good morning, everybody. Welcome to the second part of the digital banking lecture. So let's see how it goes. But today we have a big plan to go through the more recent developments in the area, in the market. And this is, of course, related to the COVID, because COVID had when you drive a car and you hit the gas pedal. So that's pretty much what was the effect of COVID on the fintech adoption, fintech development. So it was a huge acceleration in the speed of adoption of the fintech, but it also had a huge impact on the number of the companies or the number of startups that wanted to enter the market. Okay, so I'll show you in a minute a couple of figures, but there was a huge increase in the number of companies, number of services that companies were aiming to provide. Let's see. So we have realized that maybe these digital things are actually more useful than we thought they were. Okay, because before people were complaining a lot that okay, there is a privacy of data and information, so please don't track us. But then actually we realized that some of the technologies like provided by the big tech actually provide very useful information, right? Especially during such events as pandemics. So for instance, the Google mobility tracking in real time system was very, very helpful. So you could actually go to Google Maps and see which areas are busier than usual or less busy than usual, right? So it appeared to be very, very useful. So the governments had a dilemma of how to use this information, because for them that was pretty much the only source of information of how people move and where do they move, and they don't want them to move, obviously. But then on the other hand, just a year or two before the pandemic started, they were really kind of hammering big tech, especially Google, on all these tracking technologies and other data gathering processes, right? So they were stepping on their own tail in a sense. So, but yeah, in general, digital payments, they help social distancing a lot. They help to improve the targeting and delivering the support especially for the ones who are a little bit more distant from the banking system, for instance, especially the unbanked population. So all these technologies, make it very, very easier and more convenient to deliver, right? So I'm just checking. We have a few online participants. I'm just checking. If you cannot hear me, just let me know, okay? Just type something in the chat, or if something is not working properly technology-wise, just let me know, okay? Just type something in the chat. But yeah. So let's see. So we have two sides of these drivers, right? So we have the supply side and then we have the demand side. So from the supply side, we have all possible kinds of government support measures. So we have the, for instance, from the fiscal or from the monetary policy, where the government tries to support the economy, they issue some sort of a package, which would be distributed. Most of the time, it's distributed through the financial intermediaries, right? So through the basic banks. But then banks, of course, they are also part of the pandemic, so they are not isolated, so they are not immune to get the COVID. So banks try to distribute these funds in the digital way, of course. So, and that's why it kind of had a huge impact on facilitating and speeding up the adoption of the digital payments, digital solutions in general for the financial intermediation. Okay. So those banks that were some sort of existing digital solutions were very good. So they were relatively prepared. Okay, and then those who were a little bit lagging behind, then they were in trouble, because the governments obviously didn't want to transfer the funds to the banks that cannot put it forward. Right? It's the same with the universities. So some universities had been using Zoom, for instance, before the pandemic. So those who were, for example, I know that at the University of Vaasa, I don't know, I'm not sure how it was here, but at the University of Vasa, they started to use Zoom like literally 1.5 years before the pandemic started. Okay, so this 1.5 years was enough to be prepared for when all the university had to go online. Okay, so same here. So banks have some sort of a working solution how to work distantly. It helped a lot. And then also the regulatory environment, it had a huge shift, because here on the graph, for instance, you can see, so this is the changes to contactless transaction limits. So in Finland, it's been raised a little bit before the pandemic, as far as I remember, up to, I think it was 20 or 25 euros first, and then it was raised to 50 euros. But in many countries, you can see here is the list, this change happened actually during the pandemic, or right on the onset of the pandemic. So that's why, I mean, Finland was a little bit out front, but then there were a lot of countries, including the UK, which was lagging behind, which had to raise the limit during the pandemic, or because of the pandemic, let's put it this way. Okay, so I don't have the scale here, but it's roughly, you see, so the blue bar, it's the new limit, and then the red dot is the old limit. So, but it's roughly the same. I think most of the countries were making it up, raising it up to 50 euros. So this is a little bit higher because this is in pounds. So that's why I think it's 50 pounds, which at that time was maybe like 60 euros, was the exchange rate. So it's a little bit higher here. But in any case, there are a lot of regulatory responses. And some of them were also related to, for example, stock buybacks and dividend distributions. And then in some countries, the regulators put a big pressure on banks, because they said, okay, now you're not allowed to pay dividends, or now you're not allowed to buy back your stocks. But then for fintechs or the big techs, it wasn't the case. So they were freely able to redistribute or buy back, purchase back their stocks. So there are a lot of banks. There are a lot of banks in the U.S. at least who announced they're going to buy back their stocks during the pandemic because the market was pretty much down. And then it was possible for some time, and then at some stage there was some sort of a regulatory limit how much you can buy back your stock. Or at least there was some limit in the time frame for how long you will be able to do that. And then we have the demand side. So demand side is more obvious, right? So we have what we're observing right now is that it's not a one-time change, it's not a one-time shift, but we observe a habit, okay? So the habits change. So 40%, there's been a survey, 40% of people in the Eurozone, they started to use contactless payment more often, or they were not using it. Of course, it might be related to the increase in the limit, but in any case, but the thing is that another 40%, in addition to this 40%, they say that they use cash less often than before COVID. Okay, so that's why we're very fast moving away from, or much faster moving away from the cash payments. And you can see, for example, I'm not exactly sure from which country this picture is, but I would guess might be from the UK because they use meters and then feet at the same time. So it might be the UK. But you can see, for instance, already in Sweden, that there are a lot of places which simply don't accept cash anymore. Okay, and it says on the cashier that no cash or cashless points or something like that. So I've been to Stockholm not that long time ago, and they actually almost ended up in trouble because I didn't realize they didn't take any cash money. So that's why. There was just no other option to pay but through some sort of a digital solution, either with the card or then with they have this swish or something like that. I don't remember what's the name of the system. It's similar to mobile pay here. So there is a reduced mobility when you can't go anywhere, right? But you still need to do your groceries, you still need to do some other purchases. How do you do that offline? There is a convenience, so there's no need to go anymore. So everything is going to be delivered to your home. Of course, if you pay for it online as well. And then there are also a bunch of observations that show that people got a good bump in the savings. Okay, so we've seen a substantial increase in the bank deposits in many countries. And then also, people, especially in the Eurozone, when you don't get that much of the interest on your deposit account, people start to look for alternative investments and then start putting everything on the stock market. So we've seen a lot of increase in the uptick in the investments. So there's a massive increase in the market. And of course, everything is done online. Everything is done through some sort of an application, which is provided by, most of the time, it's a fintech company, a fintech startup. Okay, so let's see. We have this very fresh paper, very new. So you can see that it's from 2022. It was published in Journal of Financial Intermediation. So it's a very good, one of the top banking journals. So what they do is that they look at what is offered in the, what is it called, the either the Google store or the apps, or then the similar store, Apple store, for the iOS applications. So they have information from 71 countries for the Android devices and 56 countries for the iOS. Okay, and then they just look at this period right here, so basically 2 years on. So they look at only at the finance related applications. Okay, so any apps, so they got a list of all the apps which are available from the stores, and then they look only at which has to do something with finance. All right, would it be investment apps? So you can see here, there is a general banking app, so this would be the mobile banking from any traditional bank. There is a payment app, for instance, like mobile pay, investment app, like Robinhood, for instance, lending app. And then there is, they actually break it down into the real lending and then some sort of a maybe not so legit application. There is some sort of a government app through which you can get some sort of payments, for instance. Insurance app, and then some other apps, I don't know. So they have a lot of observations. They have a lot of criteria. They have a lot of kind of fields, and then they have a lot of information about different applications. And then they just look at the number of downloads. Well, clearly, so this is the pandemic started here. Then the black line here, the black solid line here is the kind of the total finance category apps downloaded. Okay. So, and then this is the split between Android and iOS. But let's look at this one. So this is the first case of COVID in China. Okay, so this is not that bad yet. So this is just the Chinese thing, which nobody cares about. And then this is the line where the global cases reach 100,000. Okay, so here is a huge uptick. And this is number of downloads basically this would be 15 million. Okay, and this is the average 14-day moving average. Okay, so you can see that there's a huge uptick here. And it stays rather stable here. And then this is the line where the global deaths reaches 500,000 people. All right, there's another uptick here. Stays rather stable after that. Well, there is a small decline, but it's marginally big. So let's see. So what they find is that there is a 25% increase in relative daily rate of downloads of finance-related apps. So relative daily rate means that they kind of estimate what should be the number of downloads if there would be no pandemic. And then they compare with the actual number. So this is 25% increase in what it would have been without the pandemic.
Starting from the
2019. Yeah, January 2019. Yeah. Yeah. So kind of the normal time. They consider this as a normal time. Yeah. So then 3.2, so that this 25% increase means it's a 3.2 million more downloads daily, 3.2 million daily, okay, from all over the world, 72 countries, whatever. And then, so this is 3.2 downloads more than normally, and then plus additional 1.1 million within just the lockdown period. So they track separately the lockdown period in each country, and then they calculate how much more it has an effect. So 1.1 million more. So, and it's not restricted, this kind of adoption is not restricted to one-off effect, but it's a rather long last. Okay, so I have some statistics here. So this is the 25% increase here. And this is for the lockdowns. Okay, but this is probably not that interesting. This is more interesting. So let's see who benefited from this topic. So now they split the sample based on who is the provider of the application. Okay, whether it's a bank, whether it's a startup fintech, whether it's an old fintech or whatever. Okay. So they look at traditional banks that were founded before 2000. So it's a long kind of history bank, relatively long history bank. So they find that it's right here. So this is base level, traditional bank base level. So they found this, it's a 7% plus. So traditional banks gain roughly 7% more. Then they look at the big techs. So big techs were also very active in the finance related applications. So the big tech, where is it? Here. Big tech is roughly 8% plus. Okay, so it's big techs already gaining 1 percentage point more than traditional banks. Okay, this is already kind of weird. But then also they split the fintechs into subcategories. So the first one is the ones which were founded between 2000 and 2015. I'm not sure how many fintechs were founded around early 2000s, probably not that many, but at least 2015, that was the very first wave of the fintech kind of introduction to the market, right? So, and then they also look at the fintech startups. So those are the apps which were founded after 2015. So it has a very, very short history. So they find that actually these guys are not significant. Where is it? It's here. The regular fintechs, old fintechs, there's nothing here. It's not significant, not statistically significant. But then the startup firms here, they actually gain 9% more. Okay, and this is the biggest group, the biggest increase. So these startups, the very new companies, very young companies, which operate in the fintech area, they gain the most in terms of the downloads, in terms of the adoption of the applications. Okay, so it seems like traditional banks are lagging behind actually. Right, so they're not really providing the service in the same efficient way. But then the fintech startups are the biggest gainer, and then they are followed by the big tech. This guy. So yeah, so this they split the sample. So this is for all countries together, and this is for emerging markets and developing economies. This is for advanced economies. Okay, so this would be it. Finland would be in this part. So what types of products have seen the most of the adoption? So in the overall sample, again, payments had a 7% increase. Then we have lending apps. It's roughly 21% increase. And then investment apps, it's 15% increase. Okay. And then there are some government-related apps. So this is 25%, but this is clear, right? So if you need to get a payment from the government, you need to download their app. So it's kind of clear. It's not because they are so innovative, in a sense. So right. So that's why it's so high. But then if you omit the government, then you would actually see that the lending is the most kind of growing area, in a sense, in the fintech. But then there is a huge difference between the emerging markets and development. So you can see that most of this 21% is driven by the adoption of the lending applications from the developing economies. Okay. So developing economies, for instance, well China and India would be here. And then in the advanced economies, it's much less. So it's only 12.8. But then if you look at the investments, for instance, right here, you can see that it's all the way around. So you can see that the emerging markets, developing economies, is actually not statistically significant at all. Okay. While in the advanced economies, most of this 15%, it's actually even more, it's almost 23%, is coming from the demand from the advanced economies. So there is a huge difference, right? So what kind of the demand for different applications in different countries. let's say next. So yeah, what are the implications? I mean, it's nice, cool. What else? What, I mean, why should we care? So there is a, I mean, if you look at a little bit more details in this difference here, in the lending application. So there is actually a huge impact on lending from the perspective of financial intermediation. So when you look at the, when they split the sample, so what they do now is that they look at the only at these lending apps, and then they split, they try to figure out whether it's a authentic, legit application like Lending Club or the Prosper.com, which kind of almost have some sort of regulatory approved activities, or if it's more some sort of a shady application that offers some sort of loans that you never know if you would be able to pay back. How do they do that? Well, it's actually quite easy. So you can, the easiest indicator would be just to look at the interest rates which is charged on the loans. So if it's exceptionally high, it would be a first indicator that something is probably not working right with this application, right? So who wants to pay, let's say 200% in interest on its loan? Nobody. But this is actually a true number too. 200 people are paying 200% per annum on their loans. Because, well, obviously a lot of people ended up in troubles during the pandemic. So people lost jobs, and especially in countries where the support was not that big, people had to survive. Obviously you would go and take whatever is possible, whatever is available. Okay, so they split the sample on two types of this lending application. So this is a so-called pure play lending. So this is real thing. And then this is the pure play lending, which is a kind of a suspicious. Okay, so they see only 3% increase, again, in the old country sample. They see only 3% increase, primarily driven by the advanced economies. Okay, so this one is actually not significant. But then when they look at the suspicious one, there's almost 15% in the whole sample, but this one is actually driven mostly by the emerging economies. They don't even have a number here because in advanced economies, it's legally more difficult to start a scam like that, okay, to offer an application like that. But in the developing economies, sometimes it's a wild west where everything is possible, right? So that's why this demand is driven by the developing economy. So there is a demand for consumer loans that was unmet by the traditional banks. I'm not sure if it was the technical reason or if it was the kind of on purpose. So the banks did not want to lend more at that period of time, because you remember from yesterday, we were talking that the traditional banks are reshifting suspects. So they have a moral hazard. When there is exogenous shock, they cut and run, right? It might have been the case that they didn't want to lend also. But people had to survive. So they went to whatever source is available. And then they went to the very suspicious applications like that, which is offered by the feedback. So this demand was not met by the traditional community, and it got filled up by other channels, I put it in quotation mark, other channels. And sometimes these channels are not the most clean ones. Okay, so this is the case of India. So you can see here again, so this is the number of daily downloads of the lending applications. Okay, so only India, only one country, only one type of applications. So what is it? So this is the solid line here, it's the real ones. And then the kind of gray line here, this is the kind of very suspicious applications. So you can see that it was virtually zero before the COVID. It was not existing, the shady applications. But then the ledge funds were kind of stable here. There's a huge drop here, because most likely because there was no supply. But then it actually gave
huge growth to the very suspicious applications which were involved in the land. Okay, so this is the first COVID, first confirmed COVID case in India, and this is the nationwide lockdown. Okay, so this is the one here. So there's a huge increase here, lockdown, people need money, there you go. There's a decline here, again, some up and downs in the larger ones, but then actually, well, it seems like the shady applications were started to pick up again here, so there are up and downs. But interesting part is that the real ones, the legit ones, so the level of downloads, you see that it never kind of went back to the normal. Although this is already December 2020, so this is already kind of an easier situation with the COVID. So it never went back, because before you see it was roughly, what is that, 250,000 daily. And now it's actually, well, it's roughly 150. Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think this never went back to the normal? Any intelligent guesses?
Well, if the students got themselves live, when people moved on to these shady ones, never came back. So I would say.
Yeah, well, could be the case, but I mean, this is already December 2020, where the situation was not maybe that bad already. So I think the supply side should have been recovered already at this stage. I don't think this is the supply side driven. It might be the demand side, because partly you're correct by saying that people already kind of put their hands in there. But this is remember, this is always more expensive. The shady applications, they're always more expensive. So if you're a reasonable household, why would you like to pay higher interest rates here and not go here? So this is also probably quite arguable statement that because they're already here, they don't want to go back here. So I would do what I would do if I was in the situation, I would refinance whatever I got from here with this because it's cheaper. Right, but people were not doing that.
Can they get if they are blocking the bad laws and their financial positions are worse? So can they come back and refinance with better laws?
Well, yeah, of course, it depends. I mean, yeah, probably it also has an effect. Yeah, but I think the most important part is that, I mean, obviously, when people are currently here from the shady applications, they are not aware that this is a scam, right? So they get to learn this only the hard way, only after they already put their hands in here. And after that, they learn, okay, this is very expensive, right? So a lot of people who actually were scammed in a sense, right? So, and once you've been scammed by any type of the application, what do? You try to avoid any type of the further usage of similar services. Okay, so there's a huge impact on the trust. So trust is an issue, and people lost their trust here, so never came back. I think if you extend this year, I'm sure that it's going over. It's not going to be as high as it used to be. Okay, what are the implications? So there's a spillover effect. Obviously, there is a reduced borrowing from the financial intermediaries because, well, intermediaries themselves didn't want to lend that much. But then also, people were probably not able to get the loans from banks as well. And then there is an amplifying effect where over-indebtedness, which is fueled by the fintechs, had a likely effect on the... mute everybody. Where the fintechs are likely to affect the systematic risk for the traditional lenders as well. Okay, so because people had a lot of debt now on their books, so they couldn't, even if they wanted, and if the bank wanted to provide additional lending, they couldn't because there is already so much debt which they have from this unofficial sources. And then of course the trust issues. it's not easy. I mean, trust is something which is easy to lose, but it's really hard to regain. So it will take a lot of time to bring it back to the same level. Okay. Okay, so what are the benefits? Well, obviously, it's cheaper, right? So there are lower costs of the fintechs, which drives their adoption in many countries. It's a lower delivery cost also to, you know, to for the governments, for instance, to deliver some sort of additional support. Now they have chances to make it much faster, much cheaper. Okay. Inclusion accessibility, it also helps because now people don't have to have a bank account. They simply need to download one app on their mobile phone, and this is how they get the support. So that's a big benefit. Flexibility and scalability, I mean, it doesn't matter if you have only 100 people who are downloading the app or then 100,000 people or maybe 1 million people. It's very easy to scale, right? But then also, of course, there's another side of the coin, and this is the potential risk. We'll talk about the potential risk a little bit later. But there are a lot more potential risks, which we may not be able to see at least so far. Okay, any questions?
Is there some kind of graph that shows how much of the lending is done by corporate client and how much was individual people? Just wondering, who lended more?
There is no such kind of graph, but I'm thinking from the corporate, of course, there could be some sort of small enterprises that are using the same services. But I think majority of these applications were downloaded by households, right? Because if you're a company and you need financing, if you're a big company, I don't think that big company would go and download the app. But of course, smaller and medium enterprises, it could be the users as well. But the thing is that most of the fintechs, they're not aiming at corporates, especially from the lending side. There might be in payments, yes, there are a lot of who are aiming at the corporates. But in lending, I don't know. There might be some, but not too many. Because you have to remember, this is unsecured lending. Okay, so whatever is provided through these applications, it's unsecured. There is no collateral for this type of funding. So it's usually much more expensive than whatever you can get from the bank or from similar sources. Okay, from credit unions, even it would be cheaper to get the credit. So for companies, it's very expensive to get the lending from this type of sources. So that's why I don't think there are too many of the corporates on the side. Probably there are some, but not that many. But it's mostly households, mostly individuals.
Yeah, I'm just wondering that big scale that the company's cash flows are like driven out. Would that increase the lending overall or just the payments are like much smaller and such?
Yeah, it's a good empirical question. So you can use it for your master thesis, for instance, and try to figure it out. Sounds like a good topic to me. I don't know. I'm not sure. It's an empirical question, so we need to look at the data.
I was wondering what other characteristics that are associated with the shading.
How did they define whether it's shady or not?
Yeah, what are the characteristics that are whether that's the high interest rates?
Yeah. There is a list. I don't remember now all the criteria, but interest rate was number one. Then I think the second one was they looked at, for instance, the feedback that people were leaving, because in the app store you can leave the like a review, and then also if it has a lot of stars or not so many stars. So if people were using words like scam or similar words in their feedbacks, they were kind of putting it in the category. And then there was something else. I don't remember exactly, but it's in the paper. So you can, if you're interested, you can look. There is a reference. There is a link, actually. If you click this JFI, it will open you the paper. So you can.
Default rates.
Default rates, definitely there, yes. Default rates, yes. Yes, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so I just quickly summarize what's the current state and what was the impact of the COVID on the fintech adoption. So I didn't put here before what, but it's kind of, I mean, before the COVID or before, since the inception of the fintechs, let's put it this way. So from the credit scoring, we were wondering whether the credit history and financial hard data is kind of the first best approach, right? So is there anything better than this? Probably we didn't think, at least before that it would be something better. So now there is a huge application of the big data and machine learning. So they look at the soft information. There is a fantastic paper. Where is that? It's not here. It's here. Okay, I'll get back to that on the next slide. But in any case, so the people are trying to use, for example, the information about your friendships on social networks, on social media, like in how many friends do you have on Facebook, and whether it has to do something with your creditworthiness. You remember we were talking about the footprints, online footprints yesterday. Tax-based analysis sometimes actually are found to be better predictors of default than other traditional credit scores. Okay, and this is huge. This is a game changer here. There is a paper here. So this is the footprint paper that we discussed in the very beginning yesterday. So from the online banking perspective, before we only thought that, okay, adoption of this online banking from the bank perspective, it reduces costs, okay? So it makes for banks to deliver their services cheaper because they don't need to have to hire people to sit in the branch and provide the service, but now everything can be done by people themselves online. Okay, so it was about the cost reduction. But now the technology firms intervene, and then they're actually the ones who are kind of running the show at the moment. So they're the leaders in advanced financial technologies, and banks are simple runner-ups. So there is a paper, which I give you the reference here as well. So it shows that actually large banks are much better able to integrate some sort of fintech startups. Okay, so, and this is what we observe right now. So banks are trying to take control of the technological developments, and then they try to grow startups. So they're not starting the firms up, but they're helping. So there's a lot of, nowadays, if you look at the funding structure of a lot of different fintech companies, you will see that there's sometimes there's a big bank standing behind one of these investors. So this is the paper which I was looking for. This Ravina 2019, and this is related to the peer-to-peer lending. Because before we were wondering, is P2P is a subsidy or a complement to the bank lending? But now we're more interested whether this soft information or additional information can be used to better assess the credit quality. And this Ravina 2019 paper, they actually find that beauty and age of the borrowers can help us to predict the default rates. And this is a true story. So they find that beautiful borrowers are 11.7% more likely to get a loan. They pay similar interest rates on average than average looking borrower with the same credentials, but the default rate is much higher for this type of borrowers. This is interesting, huh? You can read the paper, it's very nice, very interesting. I'm not exactly sure how they define a beautiful person, but I'm sure there are some kind of ways to do that. Blockchain. So before it was all about Bitcoin. Blockchain was equal to Bitcoin, but it's actually not the case. Blockchain is a fantastic technology, and it's not only used in Bitcoin, right? So we have a lot of applications like smart contracts and central bank digital currencies. So these are the areas which are developing much faster than Bitcoin, right? Okay. So Bitcoin just happened to be, in my opinion, Bitcoin just happened to be in the right place in the right time, and applied this technology where very, very in the good time. So, but in general, if you look at the market of the cryptocurrencies, there are almost 10,000 different cryptocurrencies which are available right now. And this is very fresh data. It's as of September 2022. So if you're interested in the topic of the cryptocurrencies, you can go to this webpage and see there's information about the market value. By the way, the total markup of this 10,000 cryptocurrencies is over $1 trillion. And so this is a very, very fast growing, because this is more than 100% increase since 2020, just in 2 years. And but of course, majority of this cryptocurrencies are not. I mean, it's just I don't want to use harsh words, because there are people who are taking it seriously and say that the cryptocurrencies are the future, and then they say that Bitcoin should be used now everywhere. I'm not necessarily sharing this opinion, but I think that we definitely don't need 10,000 different cryptocurrencies. Right? And probably if you look at the very bottom of this distribution, most of them are going to be some sort of a scam. So this is also an interesting question, the central bank digital currency. But I know that I think that Juha will be talking about it, or he already did, I'm not sure. He had some sort of information about the central bank digital currencies included in some of the lectures. So you're probably going to be talking about it later. But this is a big thing. So right now, at least, surprisingly, China is the leader in the development of the central bank digital currency, partly because they basically canceled out all the other cryptocurrencies. So they're not, it's illegal in China to use any other cryptocurrency. So that's why they're trying to develop, the government tries to develop their own. But also, I mean, European Union is like, ECB right now is spending a lot of resources in examining the question. So sooner or later, most likely sooner, the ECB will come up with also some sort of a centralized type of the digital currency. I'm not exactly sure when people ask me what's the difference between the central bank digital currency and the commercial bank digital currency, because basically right now all the money that you have on your cards is also kind of a digital currency, right? It's not, of course you can easily make it real money, but at the moment it's a digital currency. So I'm not exactly sure what are the reasons, or I know what are the reasons why the central banks want to make their own centralized system, but I'm not sure whether the banks would be better off or not from this system. Most likely, I mean, they're gonna lose quite a bit of fraction of the market share because of that, but I'm not sure. Let's see when it comes. Maybe next time when I come here, I will include something more with empirical evidence related to this. Okay, let's move on. So let's look at the regulation and the implications for the financial stability. So I have, so it's now 10 o'clock almost. So let's move on for maybe like another 20, 25 minutes. So there are two sides of the regulations, right? So when we talk about the financial system regulation, presumably any regulation is meant to make the system more sound and safer, right? So all the requirements for the banks, like capital adequacy, liquidity, risk-taking, and excessive leverage limits, exposure and concentration requirements, governance norms, they're meant to make the system more solid and safer, okay? So they're not coming just out of nowhere, but this is kind of most of these regulations and requirements for financial intermediaries, they were kind of obtained hard way. Most of the regulations actually came after some sort of a crisis. So some of the most recent regulations are actually coming from the most recent financial crisis, 2007-2009. I'm sure there might have been some more regulations coming after the pandemic when we get a little bit more time series for analysis, but let's see. So for the moment, the most recent regulations were coming from the global financial crisis. So, and I mean, the financial crisis itself, it kind of slapped the banking sector really hard. There were a lot of losses fixed by the banking sector, and there were also a lot of dealers, so banks were shutting down. But also it kind of increased significantly the regulatory burden. So there is a much more effort that banks need to put in order to satisfy, in order to fulfill this kind of requirements. So there was additional capital requirements and buffers now, for instance, for the banks introduced. There is a stricter lending policies, especially related to the mortgage lending, especially in the US. So all of this kind of resulted let's put it this way. It didn't add incentives for banks to lend more after they have to meet all these different kinds of requirements, additional requirements. So what are the consequences? Let's see. We've seen a huge uptick in the shadow banks, right? After the financial crisis or during the financial crisis. It started kind of during the onset of the financial crisis, but even after the financial crisis was over, we've seen a huge uptick in the shadow banks. So shadow banks, what is shadow banks? So shadow banks is basically some sort of an institution which doesn't have bank license, but it provides some sort of bank-related services. For instance, lending. So P2P lending from the lending club would be considered kind of as the shadow bank. Okay. And nowadays, actually, majority. So here I have that the general shadow bank market in the US residential mortgage market almost tripled between 2007 and 2015. So this is the market share. Went from 14 to 38% market share. Fintech non-bank lenders increased their share from 5 to 15%. So 3 times. Okay, during the same period. So we have an early evidence for the implication. So these guys find, again, this is Journal of Financial Economics. This is one of the top journals in finance. So they find that traditional banks, they actually cut and run from lending, in the mortgage lending in particular. And of course, this gap had to be filled, and it was filled by the shadow banks. So some sort of a credit unions, maybe, which were not really operating as the financial institutions, but they were considered, they would do the same thing as banks. So they kind of filled this gap. This increased, so now they try to explain what's the reason of this growth, okay? So 55% of this growth, of the shadow bank growth, can be explained by the increased regulatory burden on banks. Okay, so more than half of this increase can be considered due to the increased burden, regulatory burden on banks. And then 35% of this dynamic is explained by the fintech lenders. So roughly one third of this increase was due to the fintechs. Okay. This is the evidence. This is what we have. This is what kind of information we have. So what are the implications? So regulators, I mean, it's a $52 trillion US dollars industry, right? Shadow banks combined, fintechs and non-fintechs. But today it's hard to say whether it's the shadow bank is a fintech or not, because all of them have some sort of an app. All of them have some sort of an online feature, but it's not always obvious whether it's a real fintech which uses new technologies and new types of information processing, or whether it's just an old same shadow bank which went online. Okay, so it's not very obvious. That's why now the border kind of got blurred a little bit in order to, if you want to distinguish between the fintech shadow bank and non-fintech shadow bank. So it's not necessarily very obvious. So the regulators keep an eye on that. But there are already examples how some troubles in this industry, in the sector, in the shadow bank sector, led to significant consequences in some countries. Well, mostly in developing countries, but still, right? For instance, in India. In India, it was during the pandemic, especially there were some problems with the shadow banking sector in particular. So some fintechs are certainly fueling the growth of the shadow banks, although they're doing it slightly differently. But again, nowadays it's very hard to determine whether they're doing it this new way or then they're doing it some sort of an old way. So the new way is that they use the big data in their risk evaluations, or in order to better align you know, the interest rates with the longer bonds. And they are doing actually the right way because they charge higher margins for the most creditworthy ones because they know that they can pay more. But then they charge a little bit lower margin for the least creditworthy because they know that if they put additional interest rate in there due to risk, these guys will not be able to repay. So it just increases their default rates. That's why they charge lower. So in my opinion, personal opinion, this is the right way. But some of the banks do it other way around for obvious reasons, of course. It's hard to blame them. But let's see. I promise you to talk about the risk. So let's talk about the risk and the especially which are meant for the which are important for the financial stability in general. So this is, I mean, this slides here, they're based on the supervisory and regulatory issues that merit authorities' attention, and it's taken from the Financial Stability Board. The report was called Financial Stability Implications for FinTech. So you can find actually this information online as well, the official sources. But let's see, let's first talk about the microfinancial risks. So microfinancial risks are also obviously have different sources. The first one, the obvious one, is the financial source, and then there is operational source. So from the financial sources, we can talk about the maturity and the liquidity mismatches. I'm just trying to keep the track in time so we would have sufficient time before the break to cover the materials, but we are fine. So financial sources is for maturity and liquidity mismatch or the leverage, over leverage in this particular case. And then from the operational, we can talk about the governance, process controls, the third party relays or the cybersecurity. So this is all related to the operational, right? So let's look at them in more detail. So when we talk about the financial sources and a mismatch, for example, in maturity or in liquidity, it occurs when the loan, any type of the loan, is extended for a longer period of time than financing is contracted for. So when you're as a fintech or as a shadow bank, when you're giving out the loan, you're giving it out for a particular period of time, right? But then since you're not a bank, you're not allowed to take deposits. So that's why your funding base is only limited to a particular type of funding. Would it be an equity or would it be a leverage, right? And then sometimes there is a big mismatch, especially when you have to extend the loans due to certain exogenous shocks in the economy. But then your funding structure is not doing the same. So you're kind of lacking the funding to provide loans or to keep to your promises when you give out loans. So this is when the mismatch happens. So this is for maturity. For liquidity, it's assets and, when assets and liabilities have different liquidity characteristics. So that could result in the run risk. And then when we talk about the leverage, well, it's kind of a bit less relevant for the non-bank fintechs, but maybe relevant in some cases. For instance, for the fintechs which are involved in the consumer or consumer lending, simply because there are no kind of capital buffer requirements for the fintechs. So there is there is still a small number of fintechs credit platforms that engage in the leverage. So they do take some sort of a debt and provide it to the borrowers. But since they are not obliged to keep any capital buffers, or they're not subject to any capital requirements in general, so that might be a problem because, I mean, where is the limit for this leverage? There's no limit. So they can take a lot of leverage and put it forward, right? So this creates a problem. It creates a risk. And it's not regulated. Okay. When we talk about the operational sources, we can talk a lot about the governance. But for banks, you know that there is a code of conduct or the corporate governance code for banks where it actually describes in a very much detail who should be, for instance, or how big your board of directors should be, both for the supervisory boards and sometimes for the executive boards. And then also there are certain requirements related to the education and experience of these people. For fintechs, there is nothing like that. I mean, they can hire anyone to sit on their board, and then you never know what kind of people will be selected. So you never know what kind of thoughts these people might have, what kind of experience these people have, and so on and so forth. So all this, I mean, at the end of the day, it's the people who are managing the company, right? So they're making the decisions. They're making the decision whether to take more leverage or less leverage. So we don't know what are the implications of this kind of regulations for the fintechs. So, but it creates the risk, right? There is a risk right there. Third-party reliance or cybersecurity risk. So a lot of fintechs, they use the cloud-based financial services. And then most of the time, they outsource. They don't have their own cloud, but they outsource. So all the servers that are storing this information are belonging to some sort of the third parties. So, and storing information, sensible information, financial information on the third-party cloud creates a risk, right? Because you don't know what's going to happen with this cloud tomorrow. So the more digital financial sector, the more there are entry points for the hackers, for instance. And that's why, I mean, I put it here that cyber attacks, when you read on the news, cyber attacks were at least as common as Trump's tweet when he was a president. Okay, so Trump is a big fan of Twitter. So you could read his tweets. There is actually a paper that tries to analyze. So they apply the same sentiment analysis to the Trump tweets. And then they also try to predict the stock market movements. It's not only sentiment, but it's also the frequency and then whether it's targeting a particular company or not. Okay, so there is a paper that you can find it out by Googling. That is interesting as well. But in any case, so this is not the point. So from the business sustainability risk, we talked about the Monza case yesterday. Right? So we don't know how the business model of this fully digital banks, how sustainable it is in the times like COVID, for instance. Okay. So it's not, it creates risk. So imagine if Monza is still a relatively small bank, but imagine if Monza would be of the size of Lloyds or Barclays. Well, those are the biggest UK banks, real banks, well, not real is the wrong, bad word, but the traditional banks. Okay, so imagine if they would be, if the balance sheet of Barclays would look exactly like the balance sheet of Monzo, that would be a problem. Okay, and this creates the risk. This is the risk. But let's look at the macro financial risk, and this is more fun because it kind of allows us to interpret or to kind of foresee what kind of implications could be for the whole market, not only for the individual bank, but for the whole market. So there's a contagion, procyclicality, excessive volatility, and then of course systemic importance. So from the contagion as the macro financial risk, the major concern for fintech is the reputational contagion. Okay, and this is what we've seen from the Indian case earlier today, is that once somebody screws up badly from the fintech industry, it would have a huge impact on the rest of the sector. Okay, because people would lose their trust. People would think that this is a scam. Okay, whatever, even if it's a legit application, people would still have a different attitude. So there's a huge contagion effect. Much more contagion than towards banks. Although banks are also, I mean, banks already in a bad situation because people tend not to trust that much to financial institutions in general. Okay, so, but banks are more reliable because they're backed up by the regulators and the government. At least your deposits are guaranteed. So you're gonna get your money back. In fintechs, it's not the case. Nobody's behind the fintech. Nobody would step up and say, we're gonna pay you back. So that's why this contagion has a huge impact. For cyclicality, no problems in good times, it's only good. But in bad times, it might have an amplifier effect. What we've seen in India, for instance, there is a huge over leverage happening during the pandemic, right? So does the policy work through the fintechs? We're gonna talk about it after the break as well. excessive volatility. So fintechs activities are designed to be very fast. So it's a matter of seconds when the fintech makes a decision about lending or not lending to a particular customer. So it's a very fast system. Most likely it will increase the volatility in the system as well because it's so fast. And then of course, systemic importance. Well, there are not that many fintechs which can be considered as systemically important, at least in most of the cases. But there is actually, and this is what we're gonna be talking about during the case study. There were already cases when the fintech developments had a huge implication for the whole system. Okay, but this is we'll talk about it more later on. So let's see. Let me just quickly check how many slides I have more. Well, let's talk a little bit more for a few minutes. So let me skip this one. So we need to. It's not easy, right? So one good thing that, okay, let's just regulate. Let's regulate the whole sector. Let's impose certain requirements and restrictions. But it's not that easy because when you impose the regulations, you want to at the same time make sure that there is still some sort of level of innovation is happening on the market, right? Because if you put strict regulations, nobody would be interested in operating in this sector anymore because there are so big regulations, right? Similar to the banking sector. Nobody wants to start a new bank because it's so much more difficult these days. So same for the fintechs. If you put too strict regulations, nobody would like to enter them. Nobody would like to innovate anymore. So there is a trade-off and you need to balance. So, but one thing for sure is that fintechs should not become new shadow banks that hide their systemic risks under the rug or at least not on their balance sheets. Of course, there is a greater efficiency and better use of data which could provide the support for the financial stability if the associated risks are properly managed, properly documented, or properly recorded. Okay. And then another funny thing about the fintech is that they create some sort of new sources of uncertainty that we haven't seen before. So the cyber risk was not an issue, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, where it wasn't that big of an issue. But these days, it seems like it's a big issue. Especially, well, if you're a fan of the cryptocurrencies, you probably heard a lot about some sort of activities by the hackers in this field. So every now and then there are some stories popping up that this much was stolen from the crypto exchange and that much was stolen from the crypto exchange. So this is a cybersecurity risk right here. Fintechs have a great potential to expand the financial inclusion, provided that the trust is not undermined, provided that nobody screws up in the industry that bad. So then they have a huge implications for the inclusion. So those people who didn't want to or couldn't open a bank account, they will be included here. And supposedly it's good for economic growth because the more people in the system, the better it is, right? So that's why they have some potential there. But so there is a challenge. So it's difficult to make the same rules for all the new players because banks now in trouble, they have a huge cost of regulatory compliance. But at the same time, they see the same player or the new players entering the market who are playing in the same area, but they're not subject to the same regulations. Okay. And this is the problem for banks. It's like almost the same happened with taxes in the US when the Uber came. So you know that the tax license, at least in New York, in Manhattan, was crazily expensive. You had to pay more than $1 million per year in order to have a license to drive a cab in Manhattan. So, and then Uber came. They didn't have to pay anything. They didn't have to have a license. So obviously they could charge much, much lower fares for that. So for the taxi business, it was a disaster because now suddenly somebody is doing it better, faster, in a more in a better, I mean, in a more convenient way for the customers, but they're not subject to the same regulations. So there's a big problem. Same happening with banks. So there's a new players which are more efficient, which are better, more convenient in providing their services, but they're not subject to the same regulations, to the same requirements. Okay. So we have in the EU, there is an approach which says, so this is from the European Banking Authority. They issued these rules in 2017, and I think they haven't really changed since then. But the rule says that the approach says that there should be the same rules and supervision for the same services, independently of who's providing them. But actually, well, for instance, the Finnish Holvi, you know Holvi? Have you heard about Holvi? No? So it's a Finnish fintech. Yeah, yes, it can be called fintech. Fintech company which provides the services for small and medium enterprises in order to facilitate their financial kind of side of the business. So they facilitate the payments, they facilitate the invoicing system. So it's very easy. You just need to open, you just need to register with Holvi, and then they provide you all the functionalities of making the invoice, getting the payments from the customer, and so on and so forth. And now you can even issue a credit card with Holvi. Okay, so it's not a bank, but they have to be authorized by the Finnish FSA as a payment institution. So they're not a financial institution, but they're a payment institution. So this is the approach right now. So you can go Holvi.fi, I think, or maybe .com, I'm not exactly sure. So you will figure it out. So in practice, it's much more difficult than it has here. Okay, so in practice, there is a huge kind of, the current regulation and supervision geared towards institutions rather than the products and services. So this is what happened in practice. So we have different regulatory frameworks for fintech, this PSD2 Payment Services Directive. So it put the stronger security requirements for the online transactions, and then also forces banks and other financial institutions to give the third party access to the information that they store on the bank account, basically, based that the holder gives their consent. So when you pay, for instance, when you order something online, like, I don't know, from, let's say, Kotipizza, for instance, and you pay for your order with your mobile bank, it actually would ask you whether or not, something like that, I don't remember exactly, but it was something like whether you want, if you want to pay with this type of the payment option, you give a consent for an access to the provider of this payment system to access basically your bank account transactions for the next 2 days period or 3 days period or something like that. I don't remember exactly. So, but I mean, usually people just click yes, yes, next, 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 and then they want their pizza pass. But if you read really carefully what it says that for the next 3 days, the provider, this third party provider, would have an access to your bank account transactions. So they can see basically all the payments that we're going to be making in the next few days. GDPR, we talked about it yesterday. Horrible thing from the research perspective. Good thing probably for the users. They make the provisions and requirements related to the processing of this personal information of individuals. Gives more kind of control for the users over their information, but I'm not sure if anyone has ever used this control in the right way, in the way that it was meant to be. Okay. All right, any questions? If not, let's take a break. I suggest that we have 15 minutes to have a coffee, yeah? Let's take 15 minutes. So let's meet back here at 10:40. Look at the case study. So this is interesting because first of all, this are the real happenings right on the market. So it's always interesting to see how they attack the market. But then also, this case has an interesting resolution. Okay, so let's see. So what's happening? So this is the not that of high quality graph right here, but it shows the fintech valuations around the world. Okay, so it says here, as of August 2018, those were the 33 global fintech unicorns. You know what the unicorns means? It's basically any startup which reaches 1 billion valuations. Okay, so those are the unicorns. So you can see that there is majority of them are, well, kind of relatively of the same size, right? So here, for example, Swedish Klarna is here. What else? There is a Robinhood. So there's another kind of, a few of them have a little bit higher valuations. There's a Robinhood here. There's a Coinbase here. There is a Stripe here. But then there is one kind of circle that didn't even barely fit into the graph, simply because it had a huge volume relative to all the others. So you can see this is 28 and then a half, 10, but then the first number one had 150 billion in US dollars, okay? Well, it says something in Chinese here, but if you translate it, it would stand for the Ant Financial. Okay, so Ant Financial, also known as Ant Group, had 150 billion valuations. So it was considered to be as a fintech giant. So if you compare, if you put the Ant Financial on the same chart with other major banks, you would see that actually the difference is not that big. So JP Morgan and ICBC had the highest valuations here. Bank of America is right here. Wells Fargo is next. Then there is the China Construction Bank. Bank of China is right here, but somewhere here, so definitely in the top 10, right? In top 10 and financial relative to the other big banks. So let's meet the Ant Financial. So it was founded in 2014. It was a spin-off of the famous Alibaba, okay? Clearly it was based in China. So in 2004, it was formally known, or it's still known, or it's still part of so-called Alipay. Okay, so it was originally introduced as a simple payment system for Chinese online retailers. And the purpose of this payment system was to solve out the trust issues that was in the market back in the time. So the trust issues was that somebody was buying something online, but then they had some sort of a way not to pay for this product that they received. Or then from the other side, the seller of the product could, for example, ship a completely different product, cheaper product, and then just disappear from the market. Okay, so there's a lot of kind of a lot of space for scam. Okay, so this Ant Financial or Alipay were aimed to resolve this trust issue. So they basically offered the typical escrow account. Escrow accounts is that when the, you know what is escrow account, right? Or no? So escrow account is when I'm as a bank, for instance, or any third party, I'm a middle person between the buyer and the seller. So I take the money from the buyer, I keep it in my accounts until the seller delivers. Then the buyer says, okay, the product is fine. Then I transfer the payment to the seller. Okay, so this is the escrow account. Typical, it's been used for ages by the regular banks. Wasn't the case in China. So in China, there was a problem. So this Alipay found the resolution for this problem. Okay, so they offered this third-party service. By 2006, they became an independent payment system. Also, kind of basically in China, it was as recognizable as Visa, MasterCard, or the Chinese UnionPay. By 2007, it had over 50 million users with annual transactions of a little bit over 7 billion US dollars. So that roughly accounted for, well, approximately one half of all the online payments in China. But then in 2008, it partnered with the China Construction Bank, and then it started to offer loans as well, up to 15,000 US dollars back at that time at that exchange rate. I'm not sure how much it is right now. But at that time, number of users had doubled, and then annual transactions also increased to almost 20 billion. In 2009, number of users doubled again to 200 million. So did the transaction deposit. Okay. So you see, it takes basically 1 year to double the size. Nice. So in 2011, Alipay moves from online to offline. You're the smartphone app. Well, offline, I mean that you can use it basically anywhere in China. That's what I mean by offline, not like to the physical transaction. But so they made this smartphone app, and then offline retailers would scan the barcode, like in this picture, or the QR code from the phone to get the payment, to receive the payment. So at that time, I mean, this is the point where you don't need the wallet anymore in China. Having your cell phone is enough. You can make, and even if you don't have a card, a credit card on the phone, linked to your phone, it's enough to have this QR code or the barcode to take the payment from you. In 2014, they opened a fully licensed digital bank called My Bank. In 2016, so-called Singles Day, so this is 11th of November, Singles Day, they made 15 billion financial transactions on a single day, 15 billion financial transactions. The value was 1.5 billion financial transactions, and the value was 17.5 billion US dollars. Peak capacity was roughly 120,000 transactions per second. And then 1.3 million loans in one day, which was valued for 7.2 billion. Okay, so it's huge. So what it is right now, so it has almost 700 million users. So that's roughly one third of the China population. It has the whole ecosystem. Because on top of this Alipay, they have the some sort of a credit pay. They have this My Bank, which is a fully licensed digital bank. They have the Ant Cash Now, which is a consumer loan service. They have Ant Fortune, which is a comprehensive wealth management app, basically for investments. They have the Ant Insurance Services. This is also some sort of artificial intelligence-based technology. So they, again, using a different type of information in order to evaluate what should be the insurance premiums. Okay. They have the independent credit filing and scoring service, and then they also have some sort of a global biometric-based identity verification platform as well. Okay, so it's a huge kind of company which combines a lot of very, very innovative stuff. So you can see here for the Alipay, you could see that you could use it basically anywhere. This is it looks like it's the place from where the coronavirus started. Almost. Most likely the bet was paid because the Alipay is in this market. Okay. So what it is today. So this is how it looks like. It's in Chinese, but you can basically, there's a lot of things. So you can pay your utility bills. You can check the exchange rates. You can even added during the COVID, they added the information about the situation with the pandemic. They have the credit card. They have the movie and theater tickets you can purchase straight from the app. For the wealth management, you can see the information about your portfolio. What was the yesterday earnings? What is the different prices for different commodities? And then there's for the consumer credit. So this is how much you can take as the loan, and this is what's the current bill. So it's a huge ecosystem. Okay. So it was aiming for roughly between 200 and 300 billion in IPO valuations before the regulatory setback. Okay. Before the COVID, let's say in 2019, probably, they were aiming for this valuation. So there was a big IPO announced or was planned to be done on the US market. So the 2019 revenues reached 17 billion, is 2.6 billion in net profit. Net profit, 2.6 billion, huge. So, of course, it was hampered by the regulatory pressure as well. But in December 2020, it was ordered by the Central Bank of China to rectify its business. I put rectify in quotation marks because nobody knows what it means. But basically, the Central Bank of China said, hey, you cannot do that anymore. Okay. Some of the listed problems which were included in this document, on this order from the central bank, were lack of effective corporate governance, defied regulatory compliance, and engagement in regulatory arbitrage. Okay, so that was the issue. In April 2021, M Group applied to become a financial holding company. And in July 2020, they got a tentative kind of okay for IPO in China and Hong Kong. So they're kind of planning to be listed there. They didn't mention what is the valuation that they're aiming for now, but I'm sure it's not going to be as high as this, but still relatively high. So, okay, it's big, it's innovative, using new technology, new sources of information, but so what? Why do we care? This is why. They had a small thing included in their ecosystem, which is called Uibao, which is, if you, for the direct translation, would be the leftover treasury. Leftover treasure, and it basically appeared in 2013 as the part of the Ant's wealth management app. So it's essentially, it's a money market fund. Okay, so it's a money market mutual fund. Anybody can buy, anybody can invest. So it's a low risk, very liquid because it's a money market, right? And it offers high returns than bank deposits, at least in China. Okay, at that time, remember, at that time it worked. So Ant used this, their information that they get, the data that they get from the Alipay users to identify the ones with the positive balance in their digital wallets. And then they simply send them a message. They send a message said, hey, by the way, we have this Uibao, which is very good, very liquid, and it offers high interest. So they educated their customers about the benefits and then invited them to open an account. And you can do it straight from the app, from the mobile phone. Okay. Main catch was that investment at any point, you can buy this fund at any point of time, and then you can also spend it whenever you want. It's very super liquid. At some stage, so the difference here was that traditional money market funds offered through financial institutions, they were asking for some sort of a fee, like a management fee, let's put it this way. Okay, so it was varying from, well, not much, but still, you had to pay something. So in this Uibao, you didn't have to pay it, it was free. So within the first 9 months, it attracted roughly 81 million of retail investors. But by 2018, they had 250 billion under management and 170 million customers. It's pretty big. So let's see, so they took advantage of the, this is probably what could be related to the regulatory arbitrage. But there is no kind of functional regulatory policy in China related to the money market funds. And then they just simply swept a massive amount of cash into the fund. And then they grew it to such a size that they started to have a bargaining power on the money markets in general. Okay, so because you're so big, the rest of the market starts to depend on you. Okay, so whatever you decide will dictate what happens in the market because you are the biggest player. Okay. So it's very liquid, also because of its huge size. So what was happening is that the Ant Financial, they offered not only the opportunity to buy and sell this money market fund, but also to use it as the means of payment. So you could pay for your groceries, for instance, with the shares of this money market fund, because it was within the same ecosystem, right? So if the place was accepting Alipay, you could actually pay with your money market fund instead of the real money, okay, with the shares of the money market fund. So that was kind of made it almost equal to as cash, basically, right? So it was very super liquid. And then this is the information on the average interest rates on the bank deposits. Okay, so different maturities. You can see maximum you could get 2.75% per year on the bank deposits in China. So the money market fund offered over 4%. So clearly, if you have any leftover in your wallet, so if somebody would tell you right now, hey, I'm going to pay 4% on whatever you have in your wallet, would you invest? And then at the same time, you would say, but you can use this money that you have in your wallet whenever you want, at any time, obviously, right? So it's like it's a perfect deal. Why not to buy this fund immediately? So a lot of people did. So what was the impact on the banking sector? So again, imagine if somebody is offering, in addition to what you have in your wallet right now, most likely you would also go to your bank, withdraw all your money from the deposit account and bring it to the money market fund because it offers almost 2 times more interest, right? So it was a huge impact on the deposit side for Chinese banks. Would you still open a new deposit account in a bank? Probably not. Why would you? Right? Because it's not competitive enough. And then banks could react, they could increase the interest rate on deposits, but it wasn't possible for Chinese banks because it would have an impact on the whole funding structure of the Chinese banks. And then it would have an implications for the lending side as well. And probably it had to some extent, maybe not as much, but probably it had also an effect on the lending side by the Chinese banks. But in any case, in 2017, the market scale of this UBA was $215 billion. Okay. And then the total deposits of the fifth largest lender in China, which is called China Merchant Bank, were only $195 billion. So it already grew to a larger size than the fifth largest bank in China. And banks in China are usually pretty big, okay, especially in top five. So what were the other impacts on banks? So there is no more cheap source of funding for banks, so they cannot attract deposits. There is a monopolized money market right now. There is one big player, which basically dictates to the rest of the market what should be the conditions. There's these non-bank players that are similar to deposit-taking institutions, but they're not subject to the same regulations. So they don't have to care about the same capital requirements. They don't have to care about the same kind of regulatory framework in general. Okay, so there's a lower operational and compliance costs for this player. And then there's also for banks, it means lower margins, and of course, which would affect the profitability of the banking sector as well. So it has a huge impact, not only for individual banks, but also for the whole banking system, whole banking sector, which has an impact on the financial stability as well, right? Because when banks are in trouble, the whole system would be in trouble. Let's see. What was the impact on the market? So this Chinese money market fund could also extend long-term credit that is funded by the assets that can be redeemed on demand, which is potentially the same as maturity and liquidity transformation system. Okay, so they tried to fulfill the banking role in the transformation of the maturity and liquidity, because they also started to combine this money market fund with other lending activities. Yet these MMFs are not subject to the macroprudential requirements. Deposit insurance is not there, obviously. These requirements and this deposit insurance are mandatory for the deposit-taking institutions. But because these guys did not have to comply with that, it created the risk. So without this proper regulatory framing, policy decisions could also become very ineffective, simply because whenever you want to now implement, for example, monetary policy, there is a risk that it wouldn't work, simply because now the banks are not the biggest part of the system. Okay, so what is the impact on the financial system? So typically in times of the economic stress, people need money, right? So they go to the bank and they take the money. So these online MMFs could raise potential liquidity risk due to the potential maturity mismatch. So remember that they were offering, you could withdraw your money at time T plus zero. So it didn't take any time to get your money from them, right? So and it was financed in advance by the own cash of this UBA. So they didn't So basically what was happening, if you wanted to sell some of the shares of this money market fund, you got the money immediately, but it wasn't coming from the proceeds of the sale, but it was coming from the Yubao own cash. So they were paying with their own cash and only then selling some shares to the market. So it was kind of post-stock activity. So remember, so people need money when there is exogenous shock, when there is some sort of, for example, pandemic. People need money. And if there would be a large redemption, and remember that there is now, the money market is monopolized, large redemption could lead simply to the freeze of the whole money market. And that would have a huge implications for the whole system, because now even the banks, because banks are using money markets quite a lot to finance their short liquidities, right? So but now even the banks wouldn't be able to refinance in the short term. So that would mean a collapse. So this is what happened actually during the global financial crisis. In 2008. So banks, their balance sheet looked fine, but because there was no liquidity on the market, so they couldn't get the money for a short term, they had to. So this is basically how the Lehman Brothers collapsed. Okay, so they couldn't sell their assets fast enough for the reasonable price. So this is why money markets are important. So for fire sale, very liquid assets could pose an even larger mismatch and lead to a greater liquidity risk. Okay, so there is a huge implications. What is the threat? Well, the current size and rapid expansions of this online MMF became of systemic importance. So we come from too small to care, then too large to ignore, and then finally to the too big to fail. Okay, so this is the typical procedure. So if things go really bad, this poisoned MMF would not only undermine the confidence in the financial markets, but also destabilize the banking sector and harm the real economy and give the rise to the systematic banks. Okay. So what was the response? So the Chinese government stepped in at some stage and said, hey, you cannot do that. And that was the response. So online MMFs can only be sold by banks or licensed MMF agents. That was number one resolution. And in order to become the licensed MMF agent, you probably have to fulfill certain requirements. So they capped instant T plus zero redemption at a particular amount of money, amount sum of money. So they limited to 1,500. And then they also prohibited MMFs from allowing investors to make online payments with such funds shares directly. So you couldn't use it as money, basically. They also prohibited MMFs from financing the T plus zero redemption with their own cash. So if somebody is selling the shares, you actually have to sell the shares to the market and then pay the proceeds to the customer. You couldn't finance it with your own cash. They prohibited non-banks from engaging directly or indirectly in the sales of the money market funds. So you have to have some sort of a license from the regulator in order to be involved in this. So that was in 2018. They called it a substance over form and same business, same rules approach. Did it help? Well, let's see. So this is the size of this fund. So remember, this policy came in 2018. So up to 2018, here it was roughly, so this is in billions of yuan in Chinese currency. So it was roughly, I don't know, let's say, 1.7, yeah, so 1.7 trillion. So after the policy came, it started to shrink. It was the lowest before the pandemic, and pandemic had an effect. Then it was actually in 2021, it started to decrease again. So Ant was ordered actually to actively reduce the size of this fund. So it was an order from the regulator. You can't have it that big. So what they did is that these Alipay users, they received, so the Ant Financial sent a message to all the Alipay users that, hey, you need to sell your fund. How did they do that? Well, here, this is a real snapshot. So this is it says that the Huibao service is upgrading, higher returns are available. So this is the current interest that the UIBA is paying, but then this is the rate which is offered by alternative fund managed by the RSI group. And then you could also actually do the transfer automatically by clicking the button, agree and upgrade. So this is how they do that. So everybody got a message like this, and people were upgraded to a place which was paying high interest rate. Okay, but here you can already see that here the interest rates were decreasing already quite significantly. So from 4%, they went down to 2.2. Now I mean, the rest of the market is offering even higher. So this is the biggest fine in history. So Alibaba was fined a record $2.75 billion for anti-competitive behavior, whatever that means. So Jack Ma is the CEO and the founder of the Alibaba. So he actually disappeared from public. He was absent from the, because he was usually quite active in the public appearance in the media as well. But then when this happened, he disappeared from public. And then in September 2021, Alibaba company as a company, they pledged to spend additional, so in addition to this fine, they pledged that they're gonna spend $15.5 billion on Beijing's Common Prosperity Drive. I have no idea what that means, don't ask me, but Common Prosperity Drive, $15.5 billion, quite a bit of money. Okay, so did it help? Well, from the prudential perspective, probably it did. Probably it was very helpful for eliminating some sort of the risks. Did it help from the company perspective? Well, obviously not. Right, so they were spending a lot of money. They're losing. I'm not sure what were the incentives of the Ant Financial to create such a giant, but obviously they were able to do that. And if they were able to do that, I mean, it could tell you what is the road that these fintechs are taking. Maybe sometimes it might be a slippery road. Questions.
How did they manage to pay the higher interest rate? Were they like subsidizing itself from their own data to pay the higher interest rate?
That's
just like, were they making a loss on the higher interest payments?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think they were making loss because they were able to attract more people. So they were growing this fund to a huge amount. And obviously at some stage it became so big that they started to dictate their own rules. It might be in the very, very beginning, it was a catch to attract the people. Yes, they offered a high interest rate, but I think it was only for a short period of time. So they had, at some stage, they had the power to push the market interest rates upwards because they were so big.
Why they get because they weren't actually doing anything illegal?
Well, I mean, here it says, where was it? Yeah, so here it says, so this is the official listed problems. It's the lack of effective corporate governance, defined regulatory compliance, engagement in regulatory arbitrage. So the Chinese government said that this is illegal. You cannot do that. You cannot use the regulatory arbitrage. This is why you got fined. So those are the official reasons for the fine. Yeah, it's tricky. So technically, they were not doing anything illegal. I agree. But the government said, hey, this market is supposed to be regulated. So it's only meant for the particular participants like banks. And banks have to satisfy all the requirements. You're not a bank. What you're doing is a banking activity. So technically you should be regulated in the same way. So this is why they blamed it. They called it as the regulatory arbitrage. Yeah. Any other questions? No, I'll check the chat. Maybe distant participants are curious as well. No, there is nothing in the chat. So if you have any questions, those who are participating in Zoom, feel free to type them in chat. Okay, let's move on. Last part for my lectures.
And it's about the monetary policy, right? Because now it seems like the way how the fintechs function, they have an effect on the monetary policy transmission, because they're not subject to the same requirements, the same regulations, but then they're doing the same type of the activities. So if they're not subject to the same requirements, whatever the government do in terms of the monetary policy would have a completely, I mean, it wouldn't work in the same manner as through the traditional banks. Okay, and it's very important to understand how it works, because I mean, if the monetary policy transmission stops to be as efficient or as effective as it used to be working for the traditional banks, then we're in troubles. Then the government, it means that the government would have less tools how to affect the economic situation. Okay, so that's why it's extremely important to understand how it works. So you're all economists, so you got to know that how the monetary policy works and what are the transmission channels, right? So I'm not going to spend too much time on explaining this, but basically we're interested in these four major channels, right? So the balance sheet channel, credit channel, interest rate channel, and wealth channel. So in the balance sheet, it works with the asset prices and the collateral values, right? In the credit channel, it works through the credit supply. Wealth management is also about the asset prices. And then the interest rate channel is the deposit rates. Most of the time it's deposit rates, but of course it has the effect on the price of the loans, but it would be more related to the credit channel. Okay, so that's why here in the interest rate channel, we'll be talking more about the deposits. So let's look. For the balance sheet channel, when the prices of assets are altered, there is a channel in collateral value, right? Because now we have, remember the simple discount model, let's say, calculate the MPV, you discount your project with the relevant interest rate. And the same works with the valuation of the collateral. So when you want to know the value of the collateral, what would be the value of the collateral, you would do the same thing, right? So that's why when the if the asset prices decline, value of the net assets would go down as well, right? So value of the collaterals fall too, and that would lead to the slowing down in lending and also some reduction in investment and consumption. And also the decline in aggregate demand, right? So this is how it works typically, okay, traditionally. What happens when there's a fintech involved? So most of the lending by fintech is unsecured, okay? So they don't use any collateral to as the security for their loans, okay? So that's why, since they don't require any collateral, it's less sensitive to changes in their values. Okay, so they don't care what's the value of the collateral because they don't use it. So arbitrary choosing non-banks to tap the credit, fintechs may potentially numb the balance sheet channel and cause the over leverage, because nobody needs the collateral. People would be taking more money from the fintechs. Right. So it seems like balance sheet channel might be not working as effective as it used to work. Let's look at the credit channel. So credit channel, when there is a change in the key interest rates, like yesterday, the Fed actually announced another 55 basis points increase in the interest rates. A very recent example. So like yesterday would be the increase in the interest rates. So it has a direct impact, first of all, in the money market rates, right? And then also in the bank's funding base or deposit prices. Obviously, banks would need to start paying higher deposits because the interest rates are now higher in the market in general. Has an effect on the bank balance sheet in general, but once it becomes more difficult to refinance, banks would simply cut and run, right? So when they cannot get funding from the liability side, from the deposits, they will not, I mean, they cannot print the money, so they will not start lending more, clearly. Most likely, they will start lending less because they don't have funding anymore, cheap funding. So higher interest rate raise default risk, and then higher default risk bans new lending, and then it also postpones the consumption and investments. This is how it works traditionally. Let's look what happens in the fintech. There is a paper actually in the Review of Financial Studies which shows that in case of the non-bank lending or lending based on this fintech technologies, the credit channel may be amplified. And this is why. So traditional banks are based on relationship lending, right? So they build some sort of a relationship with their borrowers. And then that's why they have a lower incentive to impose an immediate burden on these existing loans. So for example, when the interest rates increase, banks, because they build this relationship with their customer, probably would not immediately, so for example, if yesterday Fed increased the interest rate by 75 basis points, it doesn't mean that tomorrow or today, all the companies with existing relationship with US banks would have to pay 75 basis points higher interest rate on their loans. No. So that's why there is some sort of a slowdown. At some stage, of course, banks will start charge more, but not immediately. So there is a slowdown in the transmission of the money from that respect. So it takes time, it takes longer period of time to for the monetary policy to start working through banks. So fintechs, they actually do not isolate companies from this monetary policy shocks, because as long as the as long as they're not, you know, they're not using their own money, they don't care what the interest rate is. So they don't care, they don't build any relationship with their customers. They don't care who's on the other side. Okay. So the only thing what they care is that there's a real person on the other side. So that's what they check. But that's about it. So and because they don't care, there is nothing that prevents them to increase the interest rates immediately. In their valuation models, where they do the recommendation for what should be the interest rate charge in particular type of borrower, like Bitcoin, the lending property. So they immediately can introduce simply a higher interest rate, which would be corresponding to the interest of the public debt. This is how it works for the credit channel. For the interest rate channel, any raise in the key interest rate triggers the rise in the real rate and the cost of capital. Right, so it slows down the investments and consumption, but it increases savings as well, right? Because now the deposits offer a little bit higher interest, so maybe people will start to save more. But it lowers demand as well, and it has the downward pressure on prices. So it also creates some sort of a tighter conditions for the labor and intermediate goods market, but in general, it's supposed to be, this is why the Fed is raising interest rates, right? Because they're fighting the inflation. So they want to create a downward pressure for prices. But let's see how it works when the fintechs are involved. So when the high interest rates, when there is a higher interest rate, it would imply higher returns on the riskless assets. Right, because now you can invest money in the money market, which is kind of less risky because it's more liquid. So, but it offers still the high interest rate now. So it would decrease the demand for the risky assets. So capital requirements and capital regulations that the banks must follow, it could create an incentive to grind down the risk taking by replacing this high yield investments by the banks, like for example in loans, by simply shifting their allocation of funds to the low risk liquid assets because they simply offer the same high interest rates. So why to bother in a sense? Why do you want to take higher risk if you can get a higher interest rate by simply investing everything in the risk-free asset on a less risky asset? For fintechs, there is no capital requirement. Okay, so they don't have to follow the same requirements that banks follow. So that's why they don't care. So this channel, the interest rate channel, can also be numbed in case of the feedback, simply because they don't have the same requirements, they didn't have to follow the same requirements. They can continue doing what they were doing. Okay. So wealth channel, fintechs presumably improve the financial inclusion and participation in the markets, so that, which is supposed to be good, because it boosts the consumer spending and assets as well. And it's supposed to be good for the economic growth as well. And then monetary policy changes may actually amplify this channel, the wealth channel, because simply there are going to be more people affected. Okay, so because there are more people in the system right now, the wealth channel might be amplified. Okay, so let's see. I have a summary page here. So how the monetary policy channels are affected. So some channels are amplified, others are numbed. So numbing would be the balance sheet and the interest rate channels. And then the amplifying would be the credit and wealth. So all the macroprudential policies, especially the most recent ones, the most recent ones are the ones that are coming after the global financial crisis, not the ones that are coming now, but also the ones that are coming on now. They're aimed at the resilience of the banking system. So, most of the time, it doesn't take into account the existence or coexistence of banks with fintechs, okay? So that's why they're not, in all the models and all the estimations and all the forecasts, whenever there's a macroprudential policy, it's aimed only at the bank sector. So they don't take into account what happens in the fintech. So all these policies that were introduced after the global financial crisis could be compromised if they can be avoided through the regulatory arbitrage by the fintechs. So this is what happened in China. Luckily, it didn't lead to the very bad consequences in China. So the Chinese government were right on time to intervene, in the sense that it didn't have any further implications for the market structure and the market, implications. But imagine if this would be happening, for example, during the pandemic, if that would be the beginning of the change in the market structure in China during the pandemic, I think then probably the Chinese government would be in much more trouble. So they were just in time. So they imposed the regulations in 2018, and then they had the pandemic start in 2020, so they were just in time. But 2 years later, wouldn't be that easy. So this 15 billion of prosperity investment by the Alibaba probably wouldn't help that much. So I have one more evidence. Yeah, so this is a very, very early evidence which tries to examine how the fintech development, in general, how the fintechs affect the monetary policy transmission efficiency. Okay, so you can see that this is the most recent version of this paper is from June 2022. They started working on this paper in 2019, if I remember correctly. But then the pandemic happened, so they had to revise a lot of their results with respect to that. But what they do is that they examine the development of fintechs in China, and then they explore the effects of monetary policy shocks change with the usage of the fintech. Okay. I gave you the link here. So if you're interested, you can click on it and read the paper if you're interested in this topic. But the results are not very promising with respect to the fintech. So the fintechs mitigate the transmission efficiency of monetary policy to the real GDP growth, to the inflation, to the bank, especially to the bank loans growth and the housing prices. Okay, so monetary policy transmission is muted and fintech credit is increasingly used. And then regulatory arbitrage and competition between fintechs and banks are the main reasons for this mitigated transmission. So whenever there is a situation when fintech steps on the tail of banks and start to compete with them, there is a problem, especially when it comes to the transmission mechanisms of the monetary policy. Okay. So those are the very early results. There is no, I tried to look before coming here, I tried to look for any other evidence and I couldn't find anything more. Because
Well, first of all, China is very good environment to test this issue because there are a lot of people who are using fintechs, right? So you can see that Alipay was used by 200, 300 million people. That's huge, or even more. And that creates a perfect setting to examine this issue. But if you go, for instance, to other countries, I'm not sure how easily you can get this data. Might be difficult. But this is the first results. This is the only results that we have so far, very early evidence. And the results are not very, not very promising. Any questions about this?
So we need to be sure that growth and fintechs are creating more unstable economic world.
Yes and no. So yes, from the perspective is that it creates additional types of uncertainties that we haven't been observing before. Okay. Yes, from the perspective that because they didn't have to follow the same regulations, it causes the problems because they can be involved, they really can be involved in the regulatory arbitrage. Okay. But no, from the perspective is that, well, people are changing, the world is changing. So we shouldn't be stuck in the same digital, non-digital banking environment. So it's good, innovation is good. But it's just, it needs to be very, very, you know, accurately designed so it wouldn't undermine the financial stability. So if it's regulated, if it's, if people know what they're doing, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. But yeah, when it comes to the uncertainties, if it's done in the environment of the Wild West, it's definitely a bad thing because it creates a lot of uncertainties which are not known before, which are not known in advance. Okay. And this is what happened. I mean, the global financial crisis is a perfect example of that. People were creating mortgage-backed securities like this. They thought it was innovative, it was cool, it was effective. But it appeared to create a lot of additional risk for the whole system, which led to the global impact. So same here, it's cool, innovation is cool, it's very nice, it's more effective. Some people get more involved in the financial system, so the inclusion is much better. But then we need to be very careful when it comes to the implications of the usage of these platforms. And I'm not even saying, so another part of the story would be the difference, like the case in India, the difference between the legit and non-legit apps, that's a completely different story. So that needs to be highly, highly monitored and regulated. So to make sure that there's no scam. Other questions? Oh no, you mean the fintechs? I didn't check, but it works in a slightly different way because it works, you know, markets are efficient. So whatever Fed was announcing yesterday probably was already reflected in the prices already the day before yesterday. So I'm pretty sure that the fintechs were also kind of preparing for this move. So it was anticipated, at least to some extent. I don't know if they expected 75 basis points exactly, or maybe they expected only 50 basis points. But in any case, they were adjusting, you know, it's not a one-day shift. They were adjusting gradually. Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah. That's actually might be a good empirical question. If you're interested doing this type of the research for your master thesis, that could be a good empirical question to see whether banks or fintechs adjust their prices faster. And what's the speed of the reaction? Might be interesting. So we have theoretical prediction that fintechs should do faster because they're not subject to the same requirements. But I haven't seen any empirical evidence about it this time. Anything else? check the chat. No messages in the chat. But yeah, I have a bunch of references for you. I think it's like 2 pages of references included at the end. So if you're interested in the topic, there is a very nice art. I tried to pick the best for you. Okay, so those are the best what we have on the in this topic right now. So you can find the whole, the most interesting ones. At least you definitely should read this one. Ravina 2019, it's called Love and Loans, the Ethics and Beauty and Personal Characteristics in the Credit Markets. So that's got to be interesting for you. But other than that, this is pretty much all what I have for you. So thank you very much. I wish you good luck with the rest of the course and the rest of your studies as well. And enjoy the field trip to the Nordean Opera, which you're going to have. This is a very cool addition to the course, I think. You have a real taste of the banking environment. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks, Dennis, there. And big applause to you for everything.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, thank you.